thirst takes blood, so is a man who kills. He is forever disposed to that thirst. Sex and violence are always intertwined in his books, and believe it, they are.
You can't exclude that she was beaten. I said my conclusion more consistent with the accidental fall.
You've come to this courtroom and told this jury that Deborah Radish, who actually performed the autopsy, is just dead wrong about it.
She is wrong, if that's what she's saying.
The defense, they haven't injected a single bit of emotion in this case. It's been science, science, science. But in fact, it's two dead women. That is a problem.
The blowpoke. They found the blowpoke.
This looks like, Obi-Wan Kenobi.
Stop fucking. All right.
Welcome back to True Crime Brewery. Today we're continuing our podcast on The Staircase, a documentary by Jean-Xavier de Lestrade. So today we're covering the final four episodes of the 10-episode documentary on the Michael Peterson murder trial. And we're going to talk about everything that happens throughout that and the final episode on this case. First of all, let's do our beer review. What have we got today, Dick?
We'll get the review of beer out of the way first.
Well, yes, because I want to open it up and drink it as we talk.
Okay. So what I did today on our third episode of The Staircase is another IPA. Maybe people who have listened to all three of them would realize or remember that the first one I did, first beer I did, was an IPA also.
Yes.
This IPA is one called Hop Drop and Roll from Noda Brewing in Charlotte. It is also an IPA at 7.2% alcohol by volume. This one's more of a West Coast IPA. Dark golden color, nice two-finger-sized tannish head that retains well, leaves a good bit of lacing, so it's a pretty-looking beer. The aroma is all citrus, maybe a little bit of sweet malt. When you taste it, you get orange and grapefruit, a hint of lemon, and maybe a touch of mango. Or there's some tropical fruit that's sweet and I can't identify as a citrus fruit.
That sounds good.
And a nice caramel taste. It is good. This is a hoppy beer, not overly hopped, not a hop bomb,
yes,
but very pleasant. So let's drink it and get on with the show.
Let's drink it. And then before we get started, I think I should say that if you haven't heard part one and part two of our podcast on The Staircase, go back, listen to those two, and then come back here, because we're really building upon the other two. You might be lost if you start here.
Yes, because we're not going to cover much of the first two episodes in today's episode.
So no, I don't want to go over it again.
Better have been listening.
Yes, so this is only for people who have listened to one and two. So if you haven't, go back, come back, get a beer, and we'll be ready for you.
Let's go.
Okay. So at the beginning of episode 7, the prosecution has rested on the Michael Peterson case, and we go to a discussion with the defense team, Michael Peterson, his brother Bill Peterson, and they're talking about should they even present a defense in this case, which kind of surprised me, but I guess that is something that they do consider. Are you waging your bets? Are you hedging your bets if you don't present a defense at all, and maybe you're safer that way? I always assume that everyone would present a defense, I guess, is what I'm saying.
Well, yeah, you'd figure they'd want to present something. I mean, I can see where they don't want to have Mike Peterson on the stand because nobody ever puts the accused on the stand.
No, that's usually a mistake, I find.
So they don't want to do that, but I would think they'd want to present some things to bolster their case.
Yes.
I think that they had done a good job with the blood spatter expert, and I think they did a good job on the cross-examination of the pathologist or the medical examiner, Dr. Radish.
Yes.
But it'd be nice to get something on their side of the story.
Well, I think so. So they kind of do an around the room with David Rudolph running things. And Bill Peterson, Michael Peterson's brother, says, who he's a lawyer, by the way, he says we absolutely need to put on a defense. And then we have Tom Maher, who seems like the most analytical person in the group, I would say. He goes over the pros and cons. The problems will be explaining how 7 lacerations occurred from a fall. But then in their favor, is they never came up with the murder weapon. They never presented that.
The purported murder weapon.
Yes, the blowpoke. So Michael Peterson, who has the final say, because it's his life after all, says we do need a defense to fill in the holes and questions that some of the jury may have. And his son Todd agrees with him on that. His son Todd seems to really be watching the jury and their reactions. He refers to some of the jury members by name.
Yeah, he seems quite familiar with them, like he's really studying the outlook of the jurors.
He's a smart young man.
Seems to be.
And may I say, a good-looking young man.
Both his boys are pretty good-looking guys.
They're all good-looking kids and smart kids.
Yes.
I think that really works in his favor, that he has these smart young people that really believe in him so strongly.
That's certainly in his favor.
Yes.
Because at the same time, I get the impression, both from what his defense team says and what his kids say, is that Mike is not that sympathetic a figure to the jury.
No, even his brother Bill Peterson says, you seem kind of oily, kind of like the rich guy. And believe it or not, Mike, a lot of the jury does not really like you.
Well, yeah, he's not a Southerner. He's from away.
And I think that goes for David Rudolph as well. I think a lot of the jury doesn't like David Rudolph.
Right. He's, even though he practices in the town of Durham, the city of Durham, he has that New York lawyer look to him.
Yeah, as we determined last episode, he did go to NYU.
Ah, yes, I forgot that. Yeah. There's the New York lawyer look.
Yes, exactly. So the decision is that they will present a defense, but it is unanimous that Michael Peterson should not testify. I mean, if he testifies, there's more to it than just how he will present as a witness. His testimony opens him up to much more scrutiny.
Right. He gets to be cross-examined by the prosecution.
Yes.
And I'm sure they're ready for that.
Oh, my gosh. They're just hoping for that. In fact, later on when they talk to the sisters are just hoping he'll testify because there's so much more they can bring up.
Right. They've been, the two sisters apparently have been doing some sleuthing on their own.
Yes.
Or maybe even at the request of the prosecution, but they've dug up some more dirt on Mike, which I'm sure they would love to share with the jury.
Well, especially Candace. She's a very angry person, which I'm certainly not blaming her. She's lost her sister in a horrible death.
She is one pissed off lady.
She is. So we're back to this meeting with the defense and the Peterson Bill and Michael's son Todd. And they're talking about what they could present as a defense. And Bill Peterson somewhat jokingly says, wait, we need a Johnny Cochran moment, a Johnny Cochran line.
If the glove don't fit, you must acquit.
Yeah, something like that, which totally worked.
Well, for OJ it did.
For OJ it did. So one of the suggestions, laughingly, was if it ain't the poke, he ain't the bloke.
That's very good.
Yeah.
I like that. It rhymes nicely.
Rhymes nicely.
And it's succinct.
Yes. So. And David Rudolph, who, there's clearly no love lost between David Rudolph and Dwayne Deaver, says Deaver's got no hair. Right? And the proof ain't there.
And the proof ain't there.
And the proof ain't there. Okay. So they have a little bit of a joke there. And then, so we go ahead to the defense presenting their case, and they start with their first witness, Dr. Henry Lee, who, coincidentally or not, was involved in the OJ case.
Yes, he was.
So first we see him come to the Peterson house, which I assume that's a flashback to when he came earlier.
Yeah, that has to be.
Yeah.
I mean, they looked like, the whole scene looked like it was from early on, where he's just being introduced and learning what was going on.
Mm-hmm. So we see him come and examine the blood spatter in the hallway, in the stairway there. It's a very narrow stairway. It's practically just a landing, and then you have a doorway going out. So there's really not much of an entryway up to those stairs. It's not the main stairway that you might have seen in pictures of this beautiful home they had. It's a back stairway.
Yes.
Yes.
It's very narrow and steep.
Yes. Henry Lee is there. He's examining the blood spatter. And one of his points is that the spatter is not all going in one direction. So there's spatter going in opposing directions, which means that there was more than one event that created the splatter. One proposition he has is that coughing could cause a spray on the lower part of the stairs as she's lying there. And he also demonstrates a cast of patterns with coughing up Jell-O and ketchup onto a whiteboard, which I'm not sure how helpful that is. It might be scientifically correct, but I didn't find it that helpful for my opinions.
Well, it's also kind of gross looking at somebody spitting stuff out.
Yeah.
I think the other thing that he was talking about was if there's different patterns of spatter, that maybe the initial fall didn't kill her. And she got up and fell again, so that could be different directions for the spatter.
Now, I believe that's universally agreed upon, whether you think that she was beaten or fell. I think they all agree that there was more than one episode. Either way, she did get up, because she had blood on the bottom of her feet. So whether she was beaten or fell, I think it's pretty well agreed upon that there was a point where she did get up.
So that by itself could be showing the different patterns.
Yes. Now, one of the things he says is that Michael Peterson's shirt, which was a navy blue, they did do the Lumalite test and there was no blood spatter found. And I think we did go over that with the, I don't want to say interrogation, but the
questioning
of Dwayne Deaver, that there was a Lumalite used that showed no blood spatter, even though Deaver was not reporting that until forced to, I would say.
Right. But that, I was recalling that that was one of the moments when I thought that the defense was scoring some points against Deaver.
Yeah. So multiple deposits, multiple directions of blood spatter, and the totality of evidence, according to Dr. Henry Lee, was more consistent with an accident than a beating.
Right.
So, of course, he gets cross-examined by the DA, Jim Harden. And Jim Harden, the testimony that we saw in the documentary was primarily Jim Harden asking Dr. Lee, "Now, didn't you sign a copy of your book for Dwayne Deaver, and you signed in the book to Dwayne Deaver, to one of the best blood spatter experts that I know, keep up your good work?"
Right, and he was trying to indicate that that meant that Dr. Lee was impressed with Deaver's work.
Right, and this got kind of cute, this moment where he says, and depending on your side, you might think that he's being deceptive, he's being manipulative, or he's just being honest, and he says, "Well, Chinese courtesy, I do believe that he did a lot of hard work, and I'm not going to write on his book, 'Oh, you're a lousy blood spatter analyst.' So, of course, I would write something polite like that. For example, I gave Rudolph a copy of my book, and I said, 'You're a wonderful lawyer,' but we all know he's a lousy lawyer." So that got a big laugh in the court.
Got a big laugh. I thought it was funny.
I did, too. I liked him. Thought he went well. But we know earlier from the surveys that they did with people in the community that Henry Lee did not do well as far as people being able to understand him or finding him believable.
Right. And I'm just not sure why. I mean, I thought he was very understandable. He does have an accent for sure.
Yes.
But it wasn't at all difficult to understand.
No.
I think it goes back to the fact, again, that he's Asian.
Ooh-hoo. I don't know.
I know.
That's a big stretch.
I've said it before. So
I'll say it again.
I'll say it again.
Yes. Well, I think that there's not a lot of familiarity maybe in that area with people from different cultures with different accents. Although he clearly spoke English well, clearly understood everything well. They did try to be a little bit tricky with questioning him, you know, repeatedly saying, "So you cannot rule out that it was a beating." And he, you know, as a professional, he looked at the jury and said, "Nobody can rule everything out, but my professional opinion is that it is more likely from an accident than from a beating or a homicide."
Right. So he's refuting Deaver's testimony.
Yes.
And he's also refuting the testimony of Radish, the medical examiner.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
And I thought he did quite a good job, but maybe that's my bias.
Well, he seemed to present well. That was my opinion also.
Absolutely.
And then, so that ends that scene, and we go to a little aside with Catherine Peterson's sisters, Candace and Lori. We know Candace, very angry, definitely on the prosecution side at this point. And they go to the Duke University Library to get some of the writings of Michael Peterson that are stored there in the archives. I'm not sure why these are there. Did he teach there at some point?
I'm not sure he taught there. He was a student there.
He was a student there, and so was Kathleen. Kathleen was actually the first engineering graduate the first female engineering graduate at Duke, which is pretty impressive.
Yeah, she was a good, smart student.
Yes.
And a successful business person.
Yeah, so they're gathering quotes from Michael Peterson's writing for the court. And they do say the only time when they'd be able to use these was if Michael Peterson was to testify, which right. goes back to what we were saying.
Yeah, we get back to that. And I don't know. I mean, he wrote novels, so who cares if he's got a lot of sex and violence?
Well, one of Candace's point was that sex and violence are always intertwined in his books. Now, that may be true. I haven't read his book, so I really don't feel like I can speak on it in an educated way.
Yeah, but maybe he felt that's how he could sell the books.
Well, I think, you know, generally the kind of books that men like to read, sex and violence are intertwined from, I know that you read a lot of those mystery novels, and there's usually violence and a mystery and kind of a tough guy, and usually there's a love interest and a little sex going on there.
Yeah, but it's typically not graphic sex or graphic violence.
No, and I don't think his books were either, from what I heard.
Yeah. So, but the likelihood of them being able to introduce that into evidence is about zero.
Well, even they know that if he doesn't take the stand, it's useless. But it gives them something to do to feel like they're helping their sister.
Right.
So after that little aside, we go back to the trial. And by the way, it's day number 49 of the trial. So we're going on 2 months here. Well, actually, if they only do it Monday through Friday, how many months have they been doing this?
Well, somewhere in one of the episodes, Rudolph talks about how they've been doing this for 4 months.
Yeah, so I think that the prosecution case took up to 4 months.
Yeah.
Yeah. So on this day, this is when the defense decides to start their defense.
Well, no, they started their defense with Dr. Lee.
Oh, sorry, you're right.
So this is another defense witness.
This is the defense that I didn't expect, I guess. So this is the second defense witness, no?
Yes, right. He is the second defense witness.
Okay. So the second defense witness, Dr. Ferris Banduk, and he is a biomechanical engineer, and he has made a recreation graphically based on the measurements, the weight, the area where Kathleen died. He has a computerized simulation to figure out if a fall was a realistic
scenario.
And it's based on the measurements, the injuries of Kathleen. And his testimony is that it's more likely that a fall caused her injuries than a beating.
Right. And I think he did a very good job presenting his data. Because as you know, there were more than one laceration of her scalp.
Seven.
And he was able to show how all seven could be accounted for by a fall, not necessarily by a blunt object.
Yes. And did it seem scientifically sound to you as a physician, a scientist yourself?
Yes, it did. I mean, I was quite impressed with his testimony.
Yeah. Okay.
And I maybe I'm a physician, but I have no knowledge at all of biomechanical engineering or what they do. But it seemed like it was a very well thought out, reasonable presentation.
Well, I mean, you have knowledge of the scientific method and which is what is acceptable in that method.
Right, and I liked his presentation.
And you found that to be much more believable than Deaver? Or how did you feel about Deaver? Well, we never really went into that.
Those are two separate things.
Okay.
I mean, Deaver's a blood spatter expert.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't like his testimony at all.
Now, why is that?
I think he was making too many assumptions that weren't based in fact. And I thought that Rudolph did a good job of cross-examining him.
Okay.
But at the same time, I think that the prosecution did a good job in getting Deaver out there, and I think that the jury, by and large, listened to everything he said.
Yes. Yeah. But Dr. Ferris Banduk was cross-examined by Frieda Black of the prosecution, and she tries to say that since he's never been at a fall physically or at an autopsy, which he agrees that he hasn't been, that he's at a disadvantage compared to a medical examiner such as Deborah Radish. But I'm really impressed how Dr. Ferris Banduk holds his ground.
I was too.
Yeah.
And he pointed out that what he was doing had nothing at all to do with being physically there at the scene. He was doing strictly biomechanical engineering.
Yes.
Stuff.
Which is how the body works in certain environments according right. to weights and measurements.
Right. So I don't see any need or any problem with him not being physically there.
So Frieda Black says to him, well, wouldn't you say that Dr. Radish, who was there measuring the wounds, viewing the wounds, doing the autopsy, was at an advantage to you in determining what caused her injuries. And Dr. Ferris Bandick actually maintained his testimony quite well, saying that my biomechanical evidence proves that a beating with a hollow cylinder would not cause the wounds that Kathleen had.
Right, and the fact that he was not there and Radish was there doesn't enter into the conversation, or shouldn't enter into the conversation.
No, I think when you listen to his testimony, you would decide that that is irrelevant.
It is.
He says, I don't understand how Dr. Radish could decide that it's a homicide just based on an autopsy.
I've often wondered that.
Yes.
I think I've mentioned that.
I think you have.
Previously.
Yeah.
I mean, you can say, here's the injuries, here's what the injuries caused, but you cannot say how the injuries occurred.
Right. Although he has a biomechanical model of how they could have occurred, which is, to me, is more than what the medical examiner has.
Well, yeah, when you look at, again, the testimony of Radish and Deaver, and how they explained the beating, Bandek's impression was much more believable. Because if you remember, the Deaver said that you had to be standing in this narrow stairwell, and you really couldn't put your arm really far above your head. So it was like the way he was demonstrating, it was just a kind of a tap on the head.
Oh, well, we're back to that. That was something. Yeah.
So, I mean, that didn't ring true.
No, it didn't.
And going back to Radish, I mean, again, I don't see how you can interpret the wounds as indicative of a homicide.
No, I think that you can interpret the wounds had to have a certain amount of impact. And one of the big points of Bedek was that the wounds were sufficient from, there was like a 25, 26 inch area where her head fell to the doorway, and the wound there would be accepted for lacerations. But as far as having a skull fracture, that wouldn't happen with that amount of weight, that
right.
amount
her,
of area.
Her height, everything, every test that he did could be explained by a fall. And again, falling, getting up, falling, that type of thing.
Well, I think even the defense concedes that it's hard to believe a woman could get those injuries from a simple fall. And I think that's the bottom line on a lot of this.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. So that's what's going on in the court. And then we have an aside again of the defense team meeting with Michael Peterson. And we have Margie Fargo, who's the jury expert. And she says, well, even on court TV, this is what I'm hearing. I'm hearing that the defense has only given us facts, 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 and forensics. There's no emotion. It's very cold. And that's a problem for us. Now, that's a problem for me because I think facts and forensics is what it's all about. Of course, there's emotions when you lose a person, but that's not the point here.
No. And I'm but, you know, TV, court TV, Nancy Grace, they're looking for the sensational stuff. And they're saying, oh, there's no emotion. There's no fire in the defense's testimony. I don't think that's their job. They're trying to present things as fact and look at numbers and so on and show explanation for how the death could have happened.
Well, yes, that's not their job, but maybe the jury is looking for some emotion. Maybe going before a jury is more than just giving the facts, and you do have to consider these things. Or why would you have a jury expert to begin with?
I'm not sure why you would have a jury expert anyway. But
well, she makes a good living at it, so there's something to it, I would say. So they haven't gotten the emotions from the defense. Michael Peterson is not super likable by the jurors. And I agree that all of this is irrelevant. We should be looking at the facts and deciding how this woman died. But in real world, I think Margie Fargo has a point. I think she's
a lot. She does. Well, she does, because the jury's going to vote not just factually, but emotionally.
Yeah.
So it would help if they liked him more.
Now, this is off the point, but in the movie Fargo, which is one of my favorite, wasn't the woman, the pregnant police officer, wasn't her name Marge?
In the movie, yeah.
Yeah.
Margie.
Margie. So that's kind of funny that this is Margie Fargo. Or is it totally irrelevant?
Well, probably totally irrelevant, but
okay.
a
it
nice
made me
point.
Think. So let's go back to the defense team. The defense team is talking. They start with Margie Fargo saying what I just said, and they're saying the forensics are going well, so maybe we shouldn't take the risk of adding witnesses to get the emotional sway. They could have witnesses, character witnesses, friends, family, things like that on the stand. Or they could put Michael Peterson on the stand. But this is probably not the way to go. I think they've decided that.
Yeah, they've already decided they're not going to put him on the stand.
So the positives of having Michael Peterson take the stand, which there are some, he can come across well, he's well-spoken, but they're totally outweighed by the negatives that the prosecution would bring up in the cross-examination.
Yes.
Yes.
I would not put him on the stand.
Okay. Well, they don't put him on the stand, so you're right. So then we have the jury visiting the house, the crime scene, and only one reporter is allowed inside during that. His name is Demoris Lee. He's a local reporter. And what he says to the other reporters waiting outside is that the jury would take turns going into the stairwell, then they would come out and take notes. They did take a walk through the house, out by the pool, but most of the activity was in the stairwell, obviously, where there's still blood.
So was anything discussed about what the jurors thought when they were in there?
They're not allowed to say that.
Okay.
So he's just watching what they're doing.
Yeah.
So the prosecution had closed their case on the Friday, and then the defense had run their case the next week.
Okay.
And then I believe it's the following Sunday that we have the big surprise.
Okay. So the defense has put forward a couple of their witnesses.
Yes.
And it's a weekend.
Correct.
And lo and behold,
early morning, Tom Maher gets a call from Michael Peterson. They have found the blowpoke.
The murder weapon.
The supposed murder weapon.
Well, the prosecution says it's the murder weapon.
Well, they've been hammering that home. So the blowpoke was found by Michael Peterson's son, Clayton. David Rudolph, Ron Garrett, and Tom Maher of the defense team go to the Peterson house and talk to Clayton, Michael, Margaret. Clayton says that he went downstairs where his car was in the garage to look for tools to work on his car, and he saw the blowpoke in the corner. So he wasn't sure. He didn't touch it. He wasn't sure what it was. He was kind of freaked out. So he went and told Margaret, and Margaret came down and said, "I think it's the blowpoke." So they went and woke up Michael Peterson, or told him he was close to being asleep. It was like the middle of the night. And Michael Peterson called Tom Maher from the team. Well, he tried calling David Rudolph, who didn't answer. Then he called Tom Maher's cell. So now we have Tom Maher, David Rudolph, and Ron Garrett going downstairs to look at the blowpoke, which is in the downstairs garage. Michael Peterson is worried that the jury will feel that this is a staged event if they bring the blowpoke in at this point. And he's also worried that maybe the police are setting him up. He's got these conspiracy-type worries, he says. And what if the police put hair or blood on it and then put it in the basement for it to be found later? So Rudolph talks to him and says, "Listen, if this was found 3 months ago, we wouldn't hesitate to add it in as evidence. The only problem now is that it's found late in the trial. So to cover all of our bases, let's have a professional photographer come in and get close-ups because there are cobwebs, insects, bugs on this blowpoke. It looks like it's been down there for years." So.
Right. It certainly does. But I know how they can be ambivalent about it, because why wasn't it found earlier? I mean,
right.
Obviously the house had been searched by lots of people.
I know, and clearly the prosecution's take is going to be that they would have found it if it was there.
Right. How did it escape being detected all these years?
Yes. So they have lighting, they have a professional photographer, pictures are taken of this blowpoke without anyone touching it, leaving it undisturbed. And then the blowpoke, with tools, nobody puts their hands on it, is put into a plastic evidence tube, and Clayton will need to be called to testify that he found the blowpoke. Well,
sure.
That's what they initially say, but then we don't see him being called in the documentary.
Well, I think they were just editing things.
So you think they did talk to him?
Of course.
Yeah.
Because they have to know how the blowpoke came to be found.
Right.
So the fact that it did get introduced means to me that they interviewed Clayton or questioned Clayton and were allowed to have it introduced into evidence.
Now, when David Rudolph is talking about putting Clayton on the stand, we have Michael Peterson saying, "I don't want him put on the stand." And I think that it's him kind of being a caretaker, defending his children, that he doesn't want them brought into it. Although there's nothing significant that would be brought in by interviewing Clayton, he does have a DUI a couple years ago. some credit card debt, but it doesn't seem significant. But I did kind of see that as being Michael Peterson being protective of his child.
Well, there's that, and there's also the fact that it just got found mysteriously after all these years. I don't think he wants him to have a difficult time.
His son?
His son.
So that is kind of in Michael Peterson's corner that he thinks that way.
Yes.
Makes him be looked upon a little more positively in my eyes.
Right, except that nobody's going to hear about that except the people that watch the documentary.
So. Well, correct, but we're two of those people.
Right.
Right. So David Rudolph brings in Tim Palmbach, who's a forensic expert, to examine the blowpoke. And he does examine the blowpoke, takes it out of the tube, actually, and sees that it's grimy, has not been cleaned, has much dust and filaments on it. And there's nothing that looks like blood. He does do some kind of test with a Q-tip. I'm not sure what test it is, but he does take a Q-tip swab to test it and says that there's no reaction that would indicate there's any blood on the blowpoke.
Yeah, this thing you could see in the segment that it was grimy and dirty and dusty and old-looking.
Well, it had some of those segmented little worm-looking things. What are those? Right. Which I've seen on old stuff in the basement before.
I don't know. Just
some kind of insect stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the blowpoke that the prosecution was demonstrating with is this nice, brass, clean-looking thing.
Yes.
So it looks to me like this blowpoke that was found had been sitting there, like, forever.
Well, yes. I don't think there's any way that this blowpoke could have been the murder weapon.
Right.
No dents, no blood, and all this stuff on it that's clearly been on there at least a couple of years. Now, in fact, you know, from a layperson's standpoint, at least a couple of years.
Easily.
Yes.
Because this trial takes place 2 years or more than 2 years after Kathleen's death.
Yeah, I think we're about 2 years out.
And from pictures of the household, it had been missing for some time before then. So it's probably 2, 3, 4 years that the blowpoke's been sitting down there.
Well, yes, at least. Well, we had the videotapes from Margaret Peterson back in 1999, where the blowpoke was not at the fireplace.
Yeah, so it's been a while.
It's been a while. So Rudolph starts feeling pretty confident about the blowpoke. It's been found. There's no blood. It's very dusty. But then they show them going into court the next Monday, and he says to Ron Garrett, "Don't be overconfident. Don't be overconfident."
You never want to be overconfident.
Yes. And this is trial day 52. So the defense, which I think is kind of shocking to the prosecution, they call Detective Art Holland back to the stand. I think that was a big surprise, at least when you look at Frieda Black and Jim Harden. They look surprised.
Yes, they definitely did.
Mm-hmm. So they call Art Holland, and David Rudolph starts questioning him, and he says,
he wanted to know if whether Holland assumed that the blowpoke was gone because they didn't find it. So it was, the implication is that it was disposed of.
Yes.
And then out comes the blowpoke.
Right. So he brings out the blowpoke in the plastic tube, shows it to Art Holland. You can see the spider webs. He says, "Can you see the spider webs on this?" And Art Holland says,
"Spider webs, I see them."
Yes. Any dents?
No dents.
No dents. And the blowpoke is actually passed through the jury, one juror to another, and they compare it to Candace's blowpoke that she brought in earlier. Candace, the one who purchased the blowpokes back in, was it 1985?
No, it was in the 80s.
A while ago.
A while ago.
So we have an interview by one of the media outside of Caitlin Atwater, who's Kathleen Atwater's biological daughter, who says this whole blowpoke thing does not change anything. Obviously, she was murdered. Whether it was the blowpoke or not, it doesn't matter. So Candace finds two other blowpokes from her family members, and she brings them into the DA.
Yeah, what's that for?
Well, in case they needed them to compare, hopefully showing that the one they found was not one of the same that she purchased, I believe.
Oh, okay. Yeah, because the other ones, they're all identical.
Yes.
Okay. So she's hoping that the one that was mysteriously found in the house is not a match for those.
Exactly, which I think she thinks it isn't. I think she thinks Michael killed Kathleen with the blowpoke she bought.
Right.
Okay. So Rudolph, during lunch, he and his team go in and they look at the blowpokes, compare them. Rudolph brings two of the blowpokes in after lunch into the courtroom, and he continues his cross-examination of Art Holland, the lead detective.
And the agreement was that the blowpokes match.
Yes. Art Holland agrees that, yes, they do match.
Right.
Yes. So then, that is where the defense rests. And they feel pretty confident that at this point, Michael Peterson will be acquitted.
Well, doesn't Frieda Black cross-examine Holland?
No.
No?
She doesn't. We go to the closing remarks after that.
Ah, okay. That's yeah. where she says the blowpoke has nothing to do with it.
She does. Now she's like, she was hammering through the blowpoke. And now for her closing argument, the blowpoke is nothing. We never said it had to be the blowpoke.
Yeah. Now, maybe I was watching a different show, but it seemed like in earlier testimony, the blowpoke was the murder weapon.
Well, I think as long as the blowpoke wasn't found, it was the murder weapon.
Yeah. And now it's found and whoops, we got to come up with an alternative theory.
Yes. Frieda Black, the blowpoke is nothing. We never said that it had to be the blowpoke that killed Kathleen. And she goes into more of a rant. Well, I hate to say a rant. That sounds prejudicial. But she goes into talking to the jury about what the core of the issue is. The core of the issue is not the blowpoke. It's what makes common sense to you, right? So does it make sense to you that it was okay with Kathleen that she go off to work while Michael Peterson sat at home and communicated with people he planned on having sex with, be they men or women? She says, there's no doubt that Michael Peterson was bisexual. She crinkles her nose up. She seems very, I'm almost going to say homophobic, or just kind of pressing on people's idea that it's not okay to be having sex with someone of the same sex. I don't know. Maybe this is my own prejudice. Help me out here.
No, I'm agreeing with you.
You are?
Yes. I think the question, this rhetorical question, is whether the jury thinks it's okay that Kathleen went out to work every day and Michael got to stay home. I'm sure he didn't just stay home and look at porn. He's still writing and trying to make a living.
Well, yeah, you go up to work and I stay home and you're okay with it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the things on his computer, she says, he had these things on his computer that were filth, pure filth. Ladies and gentlemen, this is hardcore porn, and that is not the way that soulmates conduct themselves.
Well, one person's filth is another person's thrills, I guess. And it's, you know, it's the eye of the beholder.
Yes. Which we don't really know, because we don't have any evidence either way if Kathleen knew or not about Michael Peterson's bisexuality.
Right.
So that is what I would say is Frieda Black's closing, is that you cannot believe that Kathleen Peterson would be okay with Michael Peterson's porn and talking to other men about having sex. I think she even does say anal sex, correct?
I think she did.
She did. And that if you are going to believe Michael Peterson's defense team, then you have to believe that Jeffrey Deaver is a liar.
And we know that he's not a liar.
No, she says, he is tried and true. He and Radish are tried and true because they work for us.
Right.
That's what she says.
And that's just, I love that statement.
That's great.
Just this nice circular logic.
Yeah. So then she's not doing the whole closing argument. We have Jim Harden, the DA, who comes in. And he's the one that kind of focuses on, what would you say, the sadness of her loss.
Yeah, well, I think both of them were trying to play to the sympathies of the jury.
Yes. So he shows the photographs again of Kathleen Peterson at the bottom of the stairs, Kathleen Peterson's autopsy. And he shows a picture of the fall or crime scene and says, what if those walls could talk? Well, ladies and gentlemen, Kathleen Peterson is talking to us through these walls. The blood on these walls is talking to us and asking us to give a verdict of guilty.
Very powerful statement.
So what overall do you think of the prosecution's closing arguments?
Well, they don't have the facts on their side, so they're going for the emotional side. So they're looking at, oh, this guy is a layabout, he's bisexual, he doesn't do anything to contribute to the household income, and he killed his wife. And I don't think they presented that much evidence that said he did. Or the evidence that they did present indicating his guilt, I thought was refuted quite well by the defense.
Okay. So the defense's closing We see a discussion between David Rudolph and his partner Tom Maher talking about how they should do their closing statement. What should it focus on? And they decide it should focus on reasonable doubt. So their reasonable doubts, which I think they come up with 9 or 10 reasonable doubts to add. And number one is, the blowpoke is not missing, and it was not used in the murder. That's a big reasonable doubt.
Right. That's the murder weapon, even though Frieda Black said it in closing that they never said it was the murder weapon. They sure did.
They sure did. And then number two, there's no cast-off, which is what we were talking about with Henry Lee and with Deaver, that if someone's hitting someone over the head with an item such as the blowpoke, when they swing back, you're going to have cast-off on the upper wall and the ceiling.
Right.
And there was none. Unless you're doing those small motions like shoulder to elbow, hitting, or if you're wiping the instrument with each stroke,
yes.
Which is, of course, is ridiculous.
Neither of those scenarios work.
Another reasonable doubt they mention is that there's no brain injury or skull fracture, which in every other case in the past 10 or 11 years, there has been a skull fracture and massive brain injury on anyone who was beaten to death.
Yep.
And then another big reasonable doubt was that there's no credible motive. There was a life insurance policy, but actually the Petersons were okay. They did have enough money. And there's nothing to say that Michael Peterson really cared that much about money. It was mostly his money from a book deal that paid for the house. And actually, the night before Kathleen died, he had just gotten a deal with a friend of his to have his book made into a screenplay and a movie.
So there was some more income coming in.
Absolutely. So the real issue is not whether they have proven that Kathleen died by an accident. That's not the burden.
Right.
So David Rudolph says, that is not our burden to prove she died by an accident. But did the state prove, beyond a reasonable doubt, that Michael Peterson killed Kathleen Peterson by beating her to death with the blowpoke?
And at this point, I'm thinking, based on what I've seen in these segments of the documentary, is that they're going to find him not guilty.
Mm-hmm. Well, another thing in the closing argument, which I think lasted 3 hours, which stunned me because we only saw 10 or 15 minutes, but it did stop in the middle of that and say 3 hours later. So one thing that David Rudolph said that I found really poignant was, if there was a single witness who could say one thing about Kathleen and Michael's relationship that was negative, you would have heard it. The prosecution would have brought them in and had them testify, correct?
Correct.
So no one testified that there was any trouble within their relationship. No friends, no family, no co-workers. And then he ended his closing arguments with the 911 call. And during that, we see Michael Peterson very misty-eyed, and we see his daughters crying. And it's at that point that the case goes to the jury.
So before they start, before the jury convenes to discuss the case,
and have their deliberations,
the judge gives instructions to them.
Yes.
And it's either guilty of first-degree murder or not guilty.
Yes.
There's no second degree.
No.
No manslaughter.
Nope.
Nothing else. Just first-degree murder or free.
Or not guilty, yep. So it takes 5 days to get a verdict.
I don't know if that's good or not good.
Well, it's hard to say. I think that usually they say if it's really quick, it's a guilty.
Right.
If it's really long, it could be an acquittal or it could be a mistrial.
Or a hung jury.
Yeah. A hung jury. Or it could be guilty, obviously. But it takes 5 days. And one thing I found interesting is that the whole defense team, the prosecutors, everyone's there waiting. So in many true crime or law shows that I watch, people go home and get called in for the verdict. But it seems here that they had to be there every day waiting for the verdict while the jury deliberated.
Yeah, I don't know that they needed to be, but they all seem to want it.
They were there. They were all dressed and sitting in the courtroom.
Yep.
Yeah. The verdict comes on day 5. And the verdict is?
The verdict is guilty.
Guilty. And they actually go through and ask each juror.
Yep. Individually.
Individually. They have them stand up and they ask them, is this your verdict? And do you still assent thereto? And each juror says, yes.
Yes, that's my verdict.
We see the daughters crying hysterically. And Rudolph says, obviously we'll be appealing at a later date. And the judge asks Michael Peterson, do you have anything to say before you're taken away?
I thought this was neat. He turned around to his kids and talked to them.
I know. I really did too. And I feel like, am I a sucker? Because I really felt like that was the perfect thing to do, right? It was so unselfish. It was like that's what his concern was his kids.
Right. I mean, he's already pled not guilty, so there's no reason for him to look at the judge and say, I didn't do it.
Oh, my gosh. The more hedonistic, narcissistic people, though, they do. They say, oh, I didn't do this. They feel sorry for themselves. But he just turned around and said to his kids, it's okay. It's okay. We'll be all right.
Yep. The first thing, or at least looked like the first thing that he did was turn to his kids and reassure them.
Yes. So that kind of put me on his side, too. And I thought, well, either he's really a good person or he's a hell of an actor, because that was the perfect thing to do. So he's taken away in handcuffs and he's found guilty, obviously. And that, I believe, is the end of that episode. And then we go to the next episode, which is reopening the case.
Things get interesting.
So it starts with Michael Peterson. He's in the prison yard wearing the prison clothing. And he says, I felt like, let's just get this over with now. Let's put it to an end. My children have suffered enough. And that's what I told my lawyer.
That's what he said. But I guess they also said that they've been through many appeals already.
Yes.
All of which that have been denied.
Yes.
But his attorneys have been tirelessly working for him.
Yes. And all the appeals have failed. And he's in jail for 8 years now.
Right. 8 years in jail since he was convicted, 10 years since Kathleen died.
And in an interview, he says, it's just like yesterday. I love her as much today as I did 10 years ago. He has a picture of her in his locker.
Right.
And he does look like he's aged quite a bit in these 8 years.
He looks like shit. I mean, God.
He's a frail little thing.
He shuffles along. He's kind of stooped.
Yes.
He's really wrinkly and pasty looking and gray and bleh.
Which, if he committed this crime, that's what we want to see.
What, that he's suffering?
I think yes.
Okay.
I think that's what Candace would want to see.
Well, sure.
Yes.
Candace is a vindictive bitch.
Wait a minute. Her sister, if she thinks her sister was killed by this man, she's totally on board. She's okay doing what she's doing in that case.
She's just not presented in a very flattering light.
No, and I think that the hate is hurting her own self. That she can't let it go. I feel kind of bad for her.
It's consuming her.
She's
it's going to poison her.
Yeah. It is like poison. She's hurting herself more than she's hurting him, obviously.
Yes.
Yes. So now we go to November, December 2011, where Dwayne Deaver, the blood spatter expert from Michael Peterson's trial, is in the news.
Here's where it gets interesting, folks.
Yes. So the North Carolina Innocence Commission in Raleigh is...
Well, they're investigating cases of people convicted and looking for problems with the evidence and seeing if there might have been wrongful convictions.
Right, because there might have been a failure to report things on Deaver and other people in the SBI.
Well, I guess they weren't initially looking at just Deaver. They were just... The Innocence Commission wasn't looking at specific people. They were looking at individual cases.
Okay.
And that's where we get to the Greg Taylor case, which in turn leads to Deaver.
Right. So Greg Taylor was in prison for 17 years before he was released.
He was accused of murder.
Yes, he was convicted of first-degree murder. And the State Bureau of Investigation, the SBI, a three-judge panel centered around the testimony of Deaver, was questioned.
Right. It turns out that Greg Taylor's car had some potential bloodstains on it that Deaver called bloodstains that turned out not to be bloodstains, but Deaver didn't share that evidence with the defense attorneys.
So the jury in his case was convinced by Deaver's testimony that the only way the bloodstains could have gotten on the car was if Greg Taylor had been the murderer. Of course, now we know they weren't even bloodstains.
They weren't bloodstains.
Follow-up tests show that it was not blood.
Right. So Taylor was released after 17 years in prison.
So he'd missed his daughter's high school graduation, her marriage. He'd never met his grandchild. And it was really a heartbreaking story. So Joseph Neff, a reporter for the News and Observer, interviewed Tanya Rogers, who was a juror in the Michael Peterson trial. And she told Neff that Deaver's testimony was the most important evidence presented at Michael Peterson's trial, that the jury was convinced by Deaver's testimony that the only way the bloodstains could have gotten on Michael Peterson's shorts was through an assault of Kathleen Peterson.
Right. So we've got some evidence of problems with Deaver's testimony and the work that he had done.
Yes.
In this particular case. So we know that he worked on the Mike Peterson case. So I'm sure that when David Rudolph heard about Deaver's problems with the Taylor case, he was very excited.
Well, yeah, for the past 8 years, he had been filing appeals for Michael Peterson, and they had pretty much accepted that Michael Peterson would not leave the prison unless he was in a coffin, that he would spend the rest of his life in prison. So when Rudolph heard about Deaver and what he'd done in the Greg Taylor case, he thought he now had a chance to show that Deaver did similar things when testifying in Michael Peterson's case, like ignoring facts and science to do whatever he could do to get a conviction. So there have been changes in the North Carolina hierarchy at this point, and DA Jim Hardin was a judge now, and then the assistant district attorney, Frieda Black, was no longer at the DA's office. Judge Orlando Hudson is still the Superior Court judge, however, and the new DA is Tracy Klein.
Right. She looks like she's fairly young.
Yeah.
So maybe not. Well, I guess she can't be too young because she's a district attorney, not an assistant or anything.
But she looks really much like she's at her table. She's all alone. She doesn't seem like she's had a lot of time or resources to help her with this.
Right.
She kind of seems caught off on guard by this whole thing.
She did. The defense team is ready to roll. They're trying to hear this before Judge
Hudson
and present their side of the argument in terms of what Deaver might have done for the information. Mm-hmm. And as we'll see, they did a superior job of bringing down Deaver.
So regarding the Greg Taylor case, Durham arrested him for first-degree murder. He was tried and convicted April 1993. He was 31 years old at the time, married with a 9-year-old daughter. Now, he kept thinking in the beginning, well, the next appeal will set me free. I didn't do this, and things will work out. Then eventually, all his appeals were exhausted, and he had accepted that he was going to die in prison. Then we go back to the hearing of Michael Peterson, which is really his last chance, according to David Rudolph. It's December 2011, and they're going in for an appeal.
Right.
Rudolph
says that he's taking this pro bono.
Yeah, so I don't think Michael Peterson has much money left.
He declared bankruptcy.
Yeah. Well, what did they say his defense cost?
Well, way back in one of the earlier episodes, almost $1 million. It probably cost more than that.
Yes.
And then he's had appeals that cost money.
And he's been in prison, so he's not making any money.
And he's not making any money.
I assume he lost his screenplay deal.
I don't know.
I haven't heard anything about that. So they're starting the appeal, and prior to the appeal starting, because of victim rights laws, Candace Zamperini, Kathleen's sister, speaks at the beginning of the hearing saying that Tracy Klein, the new DA, is not prepared to represent the state in this appeal.
Yeah, this was a kind of a stunning moment.
I thought so.
She was just beside herself with anger, and that doesn't seem to be very helpful to the poor district attorney who's going to be presenting the prosecution side of the story.
No, I mean, she's saying that Tracy Klein is not prepared.
Basically, she's saying that Tracy Klein is incompetent.
Yeah, she's saying the attorney general should come in.
Yeah.
And Orlando Hudson says he's going to deny that, and he's going to go ahead with the appeal.
Yeah, probably the Hardin didn't want to have anything to do with that case at that point.
Maybe. So Rudolph shows Deaver's testimony from the case that convicted Michael Peterson, and the DAs in the 2003 trial were relying very much on Duane Deaver's testimony. And this is where we see Frieda Black with her statements on Duane Deaver.
He's tried and true.
Tried and true.
And we know that he does a good job because he works for us.
Right.
I love it.
Yeah. So Rudolph says Deaver, we know now, had a pattern and practice of preparing misleading expert reports and presenting misleading testimony. And one of the witnesses that he calls to testify is Mike Klinkesum, who was the attorney for Greg Taylor. And Mike Klinkesum tells the story of how Greg Taylor's truck was near where a woman's dead body was found. And when he went to pick up his truck, law enforcement took him in for questioning, and things kind of spiraled downward from there. There was a red spot on the lower area of Greg Taylor's truck, and it was tested by the SBI and by Deaver. And the initial tests on the spot were inconclusive, and that's what Deaver testified to.
Well, I think they said it was probably blood, but could not be conclusively said to be blood.
Right.
And so then they did further testing.
Right, and Deaver did not report the subsequent negative confirmatory tachyama test.
So that wasn't blood on Taylor's truck.
No, but Deaver did not report that.
Right.
And that never came into Taylor's trial, and trial was convicted, and Taylor was convicted, and Taylor got life in prison for first-degree murder.
Yes, he did.
Yes, he did.
Then they have another witness who was, this was where things really started crumbling for Mr. Deaver.
Yes.
So they brought in a FBI director type named Chris Schweiker.
Yep. He reviewed the SBI reports.
Right. He said there were well over 200 cases that were suspicious cases.
Yes.
So this was not just a Deaver problem. It was the whole Bureau's problem.
Yeah, it was the whole SBI. They just reported their presumptive positives, and then when those positives were confirmed as negatives, they didn't file that in their reports.
Right. They were tailoring evidence to fit the prosecution's desires.
And you know what I haven't heard about this is, did the prosecutors or the DA know that this was happening? Was there pressure on them from the DA?
There's no mention of that, but I don't think there was. I think that the people in Deaver's line would know what the accusations were and how their testimony would play. So I think they were just trying to align themselves with the prosecution.
Okay. So there were 34 confirmed cases of Deaver making false reports. And then they interviewed a Tom Bevel.
Well, before getting into Bevel.
Go ahead. Yep.
They also, or is this another time? It might be.
Well, what are you talking about? Go ahead.
I think it's when they interview his investigator who looked at all of Deaver's cases.
And Tom Garrett.
Ron Garrett.
Yeah, Ron Garrett. We're going to get to that. Later. Yeah, you're right.
Yeah, because that's really interesting.
Yeah, I like Ron Garrett, I have to say.
Yeah, even though you want him to be Tom.
I keep calling him Tom, but I say he sounds like Mike, so
yeah.
I can't get that Ron straight. But anyway, they interview a Tom Bevel, who's a blunt stage pattern analysis expert, who's actually written books and teaches classes. And he testifies in this hearing regarding Deaver's testimony in the Michael Peterson trial. And he says that Deaver could not in any way identify points of impact. And Deaver had said that he could.
Right. He said that there's no way you can tell what happened.
No.
And Dr. Lee said that too. I mean, he wasn't as forceful as Bevel.
No.
But Dr. Lee said that he just disagreed with Deaver's assessment.
Yes.
And Bevel was a little more strident about it, that there's no way you can state what Deaver said.
Which makes it more believable to me because he's a bloodstain pattern analyst.
Right.
With a lot of experience, and he actually teaches the subject. So in The Last Chance, episode 10, we get to another case of Brad Bandler, the case where the wife was killed with a pocket knife after she stabbed her husband with a spear.
Right. They were having a fight. She stabbed him once or twice in the leg.
Yeah, twice, I think.
With this
16-inch blade.
Yeah, this long spear thing.
Yes.
And he apparently had grabbed a pocket knife and was striking back at her and actually killed her.
Slit her throat and killed her, yeah. But he had a huge wound. I think they said 1¼ centimeter. From his femoral artery.
Yeah, he almost bled out.
Yes. So Deaver's experiments shown in the conferences, and they were considered preposterous, according to Brad.
Right. Deaver was trying to make a case for husband stabbing himself.
Absolutely. Which is crazy. If you saw what happened to him, there's no way anyone could do that to themselves. I mean, the chance of him killing himself was super high.
Yeah.
So, as far as these blood-spattered experts are concerned, Deaver's experiments showed that if you impact a sponge, you will get splatter, and that was the extent of it.
Right. But that again is getting back to tailoring the experiments to fit what you think the prosecution wants.
Yes. And according to all experts that testified, Deaver's methodology was not concurrent with what experts in the field would do.
Right. He's coming down.
Yes. And then here's what you were talking about earlier. Ron Garrett testified for the defense, and he had reviewed all of Deaver's reports, which were very extensive. And also he had proof that Deaver had greatly exaggerated his experience. For example, 1987 to 2003, Deaver had only been at 17 scenes.
Right. And I think he said he had been in hundreds.
Hundreds, yes.
So it goes from hundreds to 17.
And before he had been involved in the Michael Peterson case, his case previous to that, the soonest case before that, was in 1991.
So 10, 11 years.
Between cases.
Between cases.
Yes.
You get a lot of experience doing that.
And they showed when Deaver was interviewed that he said he'd been at Falls, reported Falls, 15 times, and 5 to 6 of those times he did not agree that it was a fall. But actually, according to Ron Garrett's examinations of the files, there were no falls.
No falls. So Mr. Deaver not only does sloppy work and withholds evidence, he's a liar.
Yes. Totally discredited at this point.
He's toast.
He is discredited, and he's really hurt a lot of people.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe we should look into some of those other cases, because I'm sure once these are known, that other defense attorneys are just salivating at the thought of getting their people off.
I think it'd be fascinating to do that. You were talking about the woman in Boston. Do you remember her name? In the lab in Boston, who had affected a lot of cases with false testing.
Yeah, hers was more with testing for drugs and stuff, and saying that she found cocaine and things. Her name's Annie Dukin or something like that.
Okay, that might be something for us to look into for another case in the future. But let's just say that Deaver was fully discredited here. I think that can be agreed upon by everybody involved.
He was fully discredited.
Yes.
But we still have to hear from Judge Hudson.
So the last day of the hearing was December 14th, 2011, and David Rudolph meets with Michael Peterson in his cell. He says, "We have $300,000 of property set aside for your bond. We have an ankle monitor, and we have a third-party custodian set up, so that if this appeal goes through, you'll be able to leave the jail and still be supervised with those implements." So they go back to court and they go over Deaver's experiments, which are found to be ridiculous by two more experts. They go over how he lied about his experience, how there's no other evidence in the trial that could say that it was Michael Peterson who killed Kathleen Peterson. And according to Rudolph, Michael Peterson has a right to be tried without fabricated evidence. He says, "I didn't expect a perfect trial, but we do expect a fair trial."
A fair trial.
Yes.
And as you mentioned earlier, the juror that was interviewed said that they thought that that was the most damning evidence, was the blood spatter testimony by Deaver. They were pretty much hanging their guilty verdict on Deaver's testimony.
Yes, it seems that way. Judge Hudson doesn't take him more than 5 seconds to come up with his determination. He says, "Did Dwayne Deaver mislead the jury in the Michael Peterson case? Yes. Was Deaver's testimony false and misleading and play a role in the conviction of Michael Peterson?
Yes.
And is Michael Peterson owed a new trial due to this?"
Once again, yes.
Yes. So you can see celebration among the Peterson children and among the defense team. And Michael Peterson is released that afternoon on $300,000 bail. You see him shuffling out of the jail. He has his bag of belongings in kind of a netted bag as he drags behind him. His shoelaces are given back to him.
And his belt.
His belt. The beautiful house is long gone.
Yeah.
Yeah. And he goes to a smaller house. There's a company that gives him the ankle monitor, and he is out. So he says to the press that he will be happy to talk later, but now he wants to go home and be with his children and get to know his grandchild.
Right.
This is a touching moment. I saw you get a little teary-eyed as we watched it.
Well, sure. Yeah. I'm a sucker for that stuff.
Yeah. He does seem genuine.
Oh, yeah. He does.
He does. And his children are just wonderful people. I think they give him so much. just the fact that he has his children in his life makes such a difference in everything we see.
Yes, they're all genuinely happy to have him home.
Yes.
They're having parties. They're just beside themselves.
So we fast forward to 4 months later, and we have a discussion between Rudolph and Michael Peterson regarding his options. He has three options now, because this hasn't been dropped. He still is accused of this murder.
Right. But it's not, kind of not, well, some of it's not his decision. The prosecution can decide to retry him.
Oh, yeah. That's
totally
their
decision.
The prosecution, yes. So his options are, number one, the Alford plea, which is you're officially guilty, but you're just saying you're guilty so you can get out of jail.
Yes.
But you are officially guilty on paper.
Right. Which he doesn't want to do. He says, I'm not guilty, so I'm not going to do it.
Yeah.
Same with the no contest. That makes it sound like he's guilty. So he's not going to do either of those.
But there could be a retrial. And I think Rudolph actually says there probably will be. He doesn't think that the prosecutor will let it go. But there are no guarantees in a retrial if he'll go back to prison or be found not guilty.
Correct.
So those are his options at that point.
Right.
Right.
So and then, this documentary, the final episode was March or something of 2013.
Right.
So
a couple of years ago.
At that point, he still hadn't been brought back for trial. So he's still kind of in limbo.
In limbo, but out of prison.
Right.
That's the end of the documentary, but I'd like to go over a little bit of what do we think happened? What do you out there think happened? And just for my own sake, I would like to say that I am going to go with the owl theory. Now, in late 2000...
The what?
The owl theory.
Owl like the bird.
Owl like the bird.
Where did you come up with this?
Well, I've done some online research, and actually it was mentioned in a Dateline episode regarding this case by Bill Peterson, that back in 2009, this new theory of Kathleen Peterson's death was raised, that she'd been attacked by an owl outside, fallen after rushing inside, and she'd been knocked unconscious after hitting her head on the first tread of the stairs. Now, the owl theory was raised by Durham attorney T. Lawrence Pollard, a neighbor of the Petersons, and he was not involved in the case, but he had been following the public details, as most people had. He did approach the police, suggesting an owl might have been responsible, after reading the North Carolina State Bureau of Investigation evidence list and finding a feather listed. Now, Peterson's attorneys had...
Feather where?
Well, okay. Peterson's attorneys had determined that the SBI crime lab report listed a microscopic owl feather and a wooden sliver from a tree limb entangled in a clump of hair that had been pulled out by the roots found clutched in Kathleen's left hand. Now, this is her hair.
I take it it's her hair.
It's her hair.
Not Mike's hair.
No.
Okay.
That wouldn't be good for Mike. So a re-examination of the hair in September 2008 had found two more microscopic owl feathers. Now, I know it sounds crazy, but hear me out here. Because although Pollard did not speak of the theory to anyone else, the Durham Herald Sun, and I think that's the one that Michael had worked for with his column.
That's correct.
They published an article ridiculing him and discrediting his theory. But other media picked it up, propagating the Herald Sun story, which was later criticized as inaccurate. Now, advocates, including me, of this theory, assert that other evidence does support it. Namely, that the scalp wounds were trilobed and paired, consistent with marks left by talons. The feathers are similar to those on owl feet. Cedar needles were found on her hands and body, indicating that she had fallen over outside shortly before entering the house, and that Kathleen's blood had splattered up the staircase rather than down, because Kathleen's footprints in her own blood indicated that she was already bleeding before she reached the foot of the stairs, and that the two drops of Kathleen's blood were found outside the house on the front walkway, along with a finger smear on the front door, consistent with her pushing the door shut. Now, advocates also note that the owl attacks on people are common in the area, with one victim stating that the impact was similar to being hit in the head with a baseball bat. So what do you think of that?
Well, you know, you brought that up, and I said, an owl. But yeah, you know what would be convincing to me, or what has been is convincing to me, mm-hmm. is that they find some feathers that are owl feathers. I think they found pine needles or tree things on Kathleen's body.
Yes.
And if you look at the photographs and the pictures of her scalp wounds, they do look like talons.
They do. I know. They really do.
Yeah.
And although it does sound kind of crazy, according to Pollard, had an injury been presented with this evidence, it would have materially affected the deliberation of the jury and therefore would have materially affected their ultimate verdict. So prosecutors ridiculed the claim, and Dr. Deborah Radish, who we know well, she conducted Kathleen Peterson's autopsy and says it's unlikely that an owl or any kind of bird could have made these wounds that deep on her scalp.
And how does she conclude that?
Well, I don't know, but Dr. Radish's opinion was challenged by other experts in three separate affidavits followed in 2010. For example, Dr. Alan von Norman wrote, "The multiple wounds present suggest to me that an owl and Mrs. Peterson somehow became entangled. Perhaps the owl got tangled in her hair, or perhaps she grabbed the owl's foot."
Mm-hmm.
So we have a statement here from Dr. Patrick D. T. Reddig. He's a professor of veterinary medicine. And what did he write?
Well, he said that in his professional opinion, the hypothesized attack to the face and back of the head, resulting in the various punctures and lacerations visible in the autopsy photographs, is entirely within the behavioral repertoire of large owls.
Huh.
So that's a very interesting theory.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this was actually two or so years before the whole thing with Deaver blew up. So yeah. I take it that this didn't go anywhere.
Well, it hasn't, and I'm not sure why, because we had that neighbor. There was actually a neighbor who was attacked by an owl near to the time that Kathleen was killed or died.
That sounds very interesting.
Well, it is.
It's kind of like the owl theory.
Well, I do too. If she'd been attacked by an owl, got in the house, and started heading up the stairs and fallen, that would explain it. Now, as far as just falling and getting seven lacerations, I can see that's hard to believe.
It's a little bit tougher.
It's tougher. But right. As far as the blowpoke, that's hard to believe too.
I don't believe the blowpoke at all.
No.
No.
So this is where we're left. But as far as I'm concerned, I'm going to go with the owl theory, and I'm going to delve more into that.
Yeah, I kind of like the owl theory. I'm thinking that Mike Peterson is not guilty, so I'm happy he's out of jail.
Yes.
And I think the owl theory needs to be investigated more, but probably at this point it's not going to be.
Well, I mean, do you think they're going to actually bring him back to trial, or do you think it's just a moot point?
I don't think they feel like they can get a conviction, so they're not going to bring him back.
Due to Deaver's reports?
Right.
Yeah. Okay. Well, it's hard for me to let this one go because it's still on my mind. But we're going to end this series of The Staircase. But it's been a great story, and I'll definitely still be looking into it more as time goes on.
Yes, there might be updates. Who knows?
I hope so. So if you'd like to help us to continue to bring you True Crime Brewery ad-free, please visit us at www.patreon.com. That's /truecrimebrewery, or go to our website, tiegrabberpodcasts@tiegrabber.com/truecrimebrewery. And you could become a subscriber. It's only $1 a month to be a subscriber of True Crime Brewery. Now, if you have comments, questions, or any kind of feedback, you can leave a voicemail message on our website right through your computer or on your cell phone. Just click on the send voicemail link. Or shoot us off an email to truecrimebrewery@tiegrabber.com. Now, if we get enough feedback, we might do another episode on this story with feedback and our responses to it. That might be fun to do.
That would be.
Because we're just starting out here, so we don't really have any feedback in the beginning. But if we get enough feedback, I would definitely love to follow up with it.
I think that's great.
Yep. And if you'd like to give us a 5-star review on iTunes, we'll mention your name on the air. And we'll keep doing the best we can. I hope you enjoyed this 3-part series on The Staircase.
Until next time.
I'm Jill.
And I'm Dick.
Bye.
Goodbye.